Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, here to welcome you to another edition of Valley Writers Read, a program where all our writers either currently reside or one time have lived in the Central Valley. And tonight is no exception. A Fresno resident, our author is Ed Miller, a writer we've featured many times on our show. Tonight he entitles his story, Lost Roads Going Nowhere. Here he is, Ed Miller reading, Lost Roads Going Nowhere.
I know you're sitting down and you're going out and coming in and you're raging against me. Isaiah 37:28. Ted Sullivan revolved the envelope bearing an unfamiliar return address. Maybe you've won the Irish sweepstakes, his wife said. I've never won anything in my life, he replied. He opened it. Inside, he found a letter or a kind of poem on makeshift stationery, torn as from a ledger and folded several times. The hand flowed in a rising, steady current and began, "Back in town, Sully, and the city abides in its usual spidered maze of black windows, slippers of freeway light, loop ramps and split diamond interchanges, its collision of mad stars, dance clubs, posers, slackers, raves. But who's raving in the parking lot tonight as I write this? What floundering angel ginned up on the New Testament in geysered rage has chosen Dick's carpet warehouse as his soapbox Armageddon? He's been out there 3 nights now, hallucinating on cue, enduring whistles, catcalls, a hardcore evangelical, calling home the lost, the damaged, the beautiful, and the cruel, calling them home as if he knows something, calling them home as if... I opened the phone book and turned to escort services, personal. Half the pages have been torn, ripped, shredded. For a moment I indulged the fantasy, the knock at the motel door, the vast, uncontrollable transaction. Now my brother is speaking in tongues. White noise, white speed, white nights. Maybe I'll follow him to hell or show him the way. Slater. Sullivan shook his head. Enemies he could handle. It was his friends who drove him nuts. And this was the last friendship any sane person would dare rekindle. He'd let this one die a natural death long ago. The rumors that had come to him in the interim spoke of addiction and ruin, of time languished in prison and out, of dark days and wasted opportunities. Slater, poor bastard. Indeed, let it die, man. Let it rest in peace. He tossed the note. In the late part of the year, after Slater had quit Anchorage for Portland, after he'd spent it all, every dollar he'd banked working the pipeline, in a manic old-school bender that had gushed and spasmed for weeks, in the steaming, filthy wreckage of all that, he resolved to remodel and rebuild what was left of his life. He didn't recognize what he had become, which was nothing, and he didn't like where he was going, which was nowhere. Barely 31, he was just getting started. That... or it was already too late. He'd already burned and pillaged his way through one disastrous chapter, a cracked-up marriage in Maywood Park, an ex-wife and 2 children still there in a neighborhood halved by the girded shadows of the Glen Jackson Bridge and the flight path of the Portland International Airport. Okay, that was gone, that great crossroads behind him, except for alimony, child support, guilt, and worry. His girlfriend had just turned the corner on her first semester in college when she became pregnant with their daughter, Amy. Jocelyn dropped out, Slater followed suit. A couple of freshmen gone AWOL wouldn't be missed. They'd married in Reno, returned to Portland, rented a grim apartment in a nervous, gritty part of town, and hunkered down. Soon their second child came along, Stephanie, blonde, hazel-eyed, loaded for bear. Jocelyn ventured into telemarketing. She didn't like it, but pitching appliance warranties and vinyl siding was something she could do from home during the day. Slater remembered her sitting down to the breakfast table in robe and slippers, baby cradled in arm, or maybe hefted to her shoulder, as she lifted the receiver to make that first cold call of the day. At those times, he felt the most tender regard for his wife as she braced herself for the long volley of rejections to follow. The sacrifice moved him, that steadfastness in the face of hopelessness, futility. Meanwhile, he'd made the rounds of the city's half-dozen employment offices, scuffling over gray linoleum, queuing in long lines, rarely securing anything lasting beyond a few weeks, ultimately filling the shoes of a day laborer, cleaning tanks on the wharf, trenching hillside ditches, washing dishes. It was only the succession of odd jobs like these and the occasional public assistance checks, grocery vouchers, and luck that kept them from calling the curb their home. Then, some few years in, their lives began to find a domestic groove, began to find a direction revealing itself. Small and pedestrian though it was, a path that veered its way up the steep streets of their yearnings and hopes and moved them toward the sense of security that had been so elusive. They gathered up a little money and moved out to Mayfield Park, set up housekeeping, enrolled Amy in kindergarten, parked a used minivan out front. The three-legged stool was taking shape. "I love to dream," she said. So began the long dance, the wandering detour that led Slater he knew not where. He kept placing himself within its orbit. Once locked in its spiral, he knew there would be no escape, so intense was the gravitational pull. At first an afternoon flame of sorts, Socorro Menifer was easy on the eyes and spirit, someone who added blue spark to the gray margins of his day. They worked together on the loading dock of a department store downtown, Crandall's. A family-owned business, Crandall's had long enough been a fixture in the city that when new shopping malls began to populate Portland's suburban frontiers, the store's decline and bankruptcy would be eulogized with nostalgia in the Oregonian. Dark-haired and with the pleasurable air of a woman schooled in the merits of romance, Corey was employed as a product merchandiser. She wore a leather holster and wielded a price gun to ticket the items she unboxed on conveyor belts that ran from the shadowy debouchements of the freight trailers into the warehouse. Slater stacked and sorted pallets, drove a forklift, and now and then after work taverned with the shop clerks and stock boys. It was a summer job that had morphed into a winter job. Then, as the months passed, it had assumed a permanent cast. He'd taken her in his arms that day after resisting the temptation for several weeks and had whispered, "Dreams, you keep me in a daze." Her eyes sharpened. She flashed a lightning bolt grin. "You're married," she scolded. He savored the floral note of her perfume. "You have a hold on me," he said. "Don't go there," she replied. "I think about you every day. You're playing with matches." "I'm fireproof," Slater said. "That's what you think." He kissed her. Giving Stephanie her bottle in the sprawl of those remote, mizzling hours before dawn, Slater would contemplate the sleepy, fitful mystery in his arms and pace the short hallway. Afterward, he'd bundle Stephanie back into her crib and check Amy opposite in her little bed, perhaps prize the thumb from her mouth. She'd stir a little, of course, and then he'd return to the living room with its second-hand downscale furniture, its prevailing and natural darkness, and maybe light a cigarette and return to the embers of his thoughts. Corey, for example. The heady and giddy joy she'd brought him, this woman with the edgy sensuality, up from the neighborhoods of San Salvador's western zone. Slightly older than he, more worldly, otherworldly, say. He would wonder how long it would last and how it would end, the spiral crashing in on itself. And then his thoughts would detour a moment. What were the measures of Corey's desire, for example, since she too, while not married, was otherwise involved in living with someone else? Her old man, the carpenter, who kept his Harley parked on the screen porch, did she have the same passion for him, for that man, that she had for Slater? When asked, she said no, of course. What else would she have said? He didn't like to think about it, and not thinking made him think all the more. "We're so busted," Slater muttered. They were about to pull out of the parking lot down for a stolen hour of whatever, when suddenly she appeared out of the mist, westering like a storm front. Jocelyn. Corey retreated to the far side of the car. "Hello, fun seekers," Jocelyn said. "Just going to lunch," Slater replied, rolling the window down. "What's on the menu, sweet pea, or should I say who?" Slater opened his mouth, tried to flag some desperate train of thought leaving the station, but that train had left. "Just wanted to see for myself, and now I have." Jocelyn produced a document, their marriage certificate. "Won't be needing this anymore," she said. She ripped it up, threw the pieces in his face. "Or this." The wedding band followed. Slater started to get out of the car, but Corey stayed him. "Maybe don't," she said. Jocelyn offered a few departing recriminations and slammed back into her sister's low-slung sardine can. The two of them gave a murderous glare and throttled off. And that was the name of that tune. Slater staggered out of his seat. The world reeled. The stool fell apart. The marriage fell in. Tormented by sleeplessness and racked with guilt, Corey broke it off with Slater. She couldn't live with herself as a homewrecker and told Slater so through hushed sobs, admonishing him to reunite with his wife. Slater reluctantly sought the reconciliation, but Jocelyn had already initiated proceedings. The betrayal had been too great, she said, the wound too deep. Invisible wheels had been set in motion. Corey Minifer moved on, split with her live-in, and took up with Floth, the store manager. Slater quit his job. The City of Roses no longer suited the cut of his jib. Now, with his failures echoing behind him and the unwinding and embarrassing film reel of his life's events unspooling in his memory, flickering, flapping in a kind of futility at his feet, having shown him nothing, having led him nowhere, Slater could sit back still in his present disgust and loathing and weigh what he had to weigh, what he must weigh, tomorrow and the day after. And so, Prudhoe Bay, the North Slope. A call had gone out for material handlers, forklift drivers. The hours would be long, the overtime assured, the daylight gray and unending. Slater could catch up on past due obligations, get himself right with the family support division of the Multnomah County DA's office. Standing in the employment office, rereading the announcement on the board, his calculations were swift, his conclusion certain. He faxed his application at a Kinko's around the corner. Weeks later, he received notice he'd been hired. Working in Prudhoe Bay half the year, he labored the other half at Anchorage, unloading container ships from Hong Kong, Osaka, and Singapore. Working 12-hour shifts, 14, 16, working all the time. And he'd made a new acquaintance, crystal meth. The days boiled in aimless drudgery, trembled and churned, fell and rose, and Slater's routine kept him to the path of least resistance. He felt like a human pinball, emptied of passion and care, wheeling around the shadowy dimensions of a horrible machine. Enough. Head a blur, derelict and unsteady, Slater leaned to his neighbor and said, "What's the margin of error on this cheapjack, low-rent excuse of a life anyway?" The man, a stranger, looked at Slater sideways, then hit his coffee again. 10%? 20%? Slater swiveled round. "What's the Vegas line on this fiasco? How often can we repeat the same blunders? How often can we drop the ball before the authorities take us down? Take us down hard. I need to know. I need to know these things. I've an uneasy feeling I'm skating pretty close to the edge." Counterside at the Midnight Sun Cafe downtown, Slater tallied the accumulated disasters while waiting for his skillet entree. Disasters ticked on a napkin. Forgot Stephanie's birthday here. Blew off the supervisor there. And wasted again, lied to ex again, failed to make amends with world again, then out of space and onto another napkin. It went on, all too depressing, all too wretched to enumerate. He considered his options. Leaving this place, but going where? Running out of couches to crash on. No rest for the dead, no escape from the past. No way forward, no way back. If only his name were Skillet Entree. If only he had a cabin in the pine woods where he might tend a small garden in a button of sunlight and raise peafowl and chickens. He would have liked to have had a cigarette and pondered the possibilities of emancipated identity, but times had changed. You couldn't smoke in coffee shops like you could in the old days. You couldn't rub out the past like a butt in an ashtray. You couldn't do much, Slater ventured, except wait for the long sky to fall through your pockets on its way to the ground, where you would follow soon after. Knowing that, he concluded, might help. His neighbor slid his coffee aside, rapped his knuckles. "What part of France are you from?" he said. Slater wrote that down. "Jimmy," his mother exclaimed, hearing his voice. They chatted a while, that quick familiarity of the heart's terrain. "I'd like to come and see you," he said, "for a few days. I need a harbor." "That wouldn't mess things up, with your situation, I mean, with Mr. Personality." He'd met Ralph, his mother's boyfriend, once. The distrust was mutual. He remembered the salt and pepper beard, the diamond earring, the loafer's paunch. Nor could he forget the Elvis belt buckle and lizard skin boots. Ralph and Libby met playing casino slots on a Paiute reservation overlooking the Columbia. They'd taken seats next to each other at a bank of Wheel of Fortune machines. She'd won a small jackpot. He lit her cigarettes, cheered her on. One thing led to another. They dined in the casino's Spirit House buffet, its walls adorned by neon kachinas, dreamcatchers, images of coyote and buffalo. Then they were back at her place, very late, sacked in her old brass bed, finishing a six-pack of Michelob. Ralph hadn't moved far off the farm since. As his license was suspended, the job of chauffeuring Ralph fell to Libby. He got by in a small disability check of some kind, yet Slater also knew his mother loaned him money, and he knew his mother hadn't told him everything. All this floated through Slater's mind as he held the phone in his hand. It ticked him off. "I'd love to see you," his mother continued. "I miss you, but on the other thing, what you asked about, let me check." "It's your house, Mom." "Oh, I know." "Ralph's there?" "Yes." "With you now?" His mother didn't respond. "Timing," Slater said. "Timing," his mother replied. A few weeks passed, and Slater arrived in Coos Bay, having shouldered himself to the window of a greyhound and half slept as the bus wound its way down the long coast and stood now in the damp street outside his mother's tired little bungalow. As he walked up a sidewalk matted with pine needles and turned into the unkempt yard, he could hear arguing. His mother's voice, Ralph's voice, back and forth. "I pay the bills around here," his mother was saying. "Oh, yeah? What about that cable bill? I paid for that. Plus, I bought groceries last." "You don't pay for anything, Ralph. Come on. You don't help with the rent, with the whatever. The money for the cable came from me." "No, it didn't. You're the only one around here to watch it anyway. I work all day. You freeloaded the whole time we've been together." Slater put a forefinger to his temple. Boom. He thumbed the straps of his backpack, slipped it off, let it drop. Why did he always have to walk in on something? He rarely saw his mother, but when he did, it was always the same. Some crazed two-bit melodrama, a white trash soap opera. He felt like turning around, leaving the way he'd come. If he were smart, he'd do it. He knocked on the door. The bickering collided mid-sentence, fell to pieces. "Hey," Ralph said, answering the door. "Hey, guy." A cloudy stench of beer greeted Slater and washed past him. Libby pushed Ralph aside and gave Slater a theatrical hug. "Come on in," she said. The mother and child reunion was strained, as Slater had expected. his mother's mascara was too heavy and carelessly applied. She was chain-smoking and her eyes were bloodshot. Her teeth bore lipstick smears and her capris were hunched and too tight for a woman her age. Good old Mom, a standing fright. "How are you, honey?" she said as they turned into the tiny living room. "Well," he said, "I'm divorced, broke, exhausted. Let's see, an absent father, a prodigal son. Order up one post-mortem, Mom." "I'll make you something to eat." "Why not?" Slater said. "We're having subs. How about a Budweiser?" "Sounds great," Slater said. After lunch, the three of them sat around and demolished the 12-pack. Ralph asked about Slater's time in the oil fields. What did he think of Dead Horse? It had to be lonely up there. Was the money good? The money had to be good. Was Slater going north again next year to work? "Not if I can help it," Slater said. His mother asked about the girls, how they were doing. Did Slater have any new photos of her grandkids? He didn't. A pang struck him. "I don't talk to them enough," he remarked. "I mean, I don't see them." His mother sighed. She peered into the space between them, the coffee table occupied with her crossed ankles, her feet loose in woolen socks. She withdrew another Marlboro from its pack. Ralph gave her a hit from his Zippo. "Thanks, hon," she said. Days drizzled by with the late October rain, and Slater got word from Ted Sullivan, an old pal and pub crawler from his warehouse days, that Corey had migrated south. "The Bay Area," he said, their connection fading and strange. "San Francisco?" "Yeah, Floss sick about it. She has the power, Sully. I don't know what she saw in him." "I'm the wrong guy to ask." "Well, she's just a wandering child, you know. Going up and down in the land." Slater let the news idle its way around his head. He couldn't blame her for leaving him. She'd have been crazy to have thrown herself into the noise and aftermath of all that. Emerging from the wreckage of his divorce, he'd been left a sputtering fool in a financial ruin. Corey had her reasons, indeed. Even so, he'd been right about her from the beginning. She wasn't a woman to be taken lightly or for granted. The things that were right about her were the things that contrasted so starkly with Joe. The complete ease of loving her, the symmetry of temperament. She wasn't difficult. She understood him, nor did she nag him about small matters. There was simply an effortless companionship about her. That initial impression, you could take it to the bank. San Francisco, open your golden gate. He first met Tanner at the foot of the stairs. There had been a yelp, a tumble, a crash. It was in the vague hours before dawn, and Slater had been sitting and drinking wine and watching the fairy lights of the city from his window side and thinking about things, thinking about Amy and Steph and another one of those sudden moments of clarity and weakness, about their skin little knees and their charging about and their uncontrollable fits of delight, and about the immense gulf in his life, the chasm of emptiness that stretched from where he was today to where he had been once long ago. But he heard this tumble, like a melon going down a chute, and he heard this crash. He opened the door. A man was lying there flat-backed, sprawled in an attitude of apparent agony on the battered carpet. The man's eyes flickered and opened. "Oh, wow," the man said. "Are you all right?" Slater asked. "Oh, wow." The man started laughing. Slater closed the door. Some weeks later, he found himself in Tanner's room, surrounded by hoodlums and dope. It was a typical gallery, folding metal chairs, bare tick mattress, second-hand couch, dead TV set in the corner. Baby Ruth wrappers and empty Yoo-hoo bottles scattered here and there. On the floor, blister packs of various Class II narcotics. Contending for space, on the bureau were bundles of crank and bags of weed. Everything the doctor ordered. Guests just had to watch where they stepped. Slater had lately taken to making a few modest purchases from Tanner, mostly out of convenience. Tanner lived one floor up from Slater and was by far a closer and safer connection than the Transbay Terminal, where he usually went to score. Slater's building, the Marymount, was an old Keystone affair on Jefferson, just two blocks north of the Mission. Next door stood a methadone clinic run by well-meaning volunteers and recovering junkies. Next to that, a Catholic charity storefront operation. Of course, there was an endless swarm of freaks running around, crazy scenes going down, weird arguments ricocheting up from the street at all hours of the day and night. "Hey, don't mess with me, man. Quit hassling me. I'm talking to you." Slater would shift his way onto the fire escape and survey the street below. Beneath a laddered grid of street lamps and muni power lines, there would be, often as not, nothing more than a lone figure standing on the sidewalk, one perfect human shambles, head askew and babbling to himself nonstop. Or this, Slater would hear somebody taking a savage beating, screams, hollering, or worse, a quick settlement of accounts, a small caliber muzzle blast at close range, tires spinning, hopping, gaining traction. The neighborhood had seen better days. In the Marymount's lobby, there were yards of cyclone fencing, forming a kind of vaulted cage around the registration desk. The concierge, Min, was a hard-eyed, chain-smoking grandmother from Seoul. Doubtless she'd been on the receiving end of some heavy invective over the years. She needed the protection. Who wouldn't? Slater treated Min like royalty, arguably because he was so slow with the rent. Yet for some reason she tolerated him. The following year, Min would fall over dead in her pink bathrobe, a crumpled Winston 100 in her lips. There were, too, a few cold nights when the fog held and the moon was up, and Slater could contemplate the imposing silhouette of Alcatraz from the rooftop of the building. On those nights, the rock always looked its best, its most iconic and enduring, a floating necropolis awaiting the homecoming of ghosts. Looking the other way offered a twisted view of a large billboard, one that could be seen from the iron stairs if Slater leaned just right. In the daylight, the sign said, "Don't give up. Pray. It works." At night, though, among the beer-dimmed shadows, neon blasts of liquor store doorways and police substation floodlights, the message was transformed. At those times, the sign said, "Don't pray. Give up. It works." Slater didn't know which to prefer, the promise of eternity or the deliverance of oblivion. Likewise, the castaway residents of Marymount seemed to have been dredged from America's strange and far-flung backwaters. Ex-felons, parolees, night riders, addicts, and losers washed in and out of the place on a lunar tide. Hollow-eyed, rucksacks over their shoulders, going and coming, restless and beat. Slater had roomed at the Marymount all of 7 months and was considered a veteran, rather old school. Some, on the other hand, were simply misfits, dropouts, kids like Brandon De La Cruz and Len Martin, for example, abandoning the angst and ennui of insufferable lives somewhere down south or in the Midwest, unchurching themselves from the Bible Belt and arriving in San Francisco like refugees, footloose and straight out of the closet. They plied the bathhouses, the bars, the clubs, the street corners, and the tenderloin, picking up money and action wherever, however they could. And then there were other colder nights when the city itself seemed to be awaiting the arrival of something, as if the world had come to an abrupt intermission, with the climax, the mysterious finale, just around the corner. "You left me there, man, to die." Tanner was talking and tying up a boot string clenched in his teeth, eyes searching the wastelands of his arm for a vein. "A real Samaritan." "You look like a criminal," Slater said. "You look like bad news." Tanner made one stab with a spike, and in it went, and he stiffened a bit as a speed purled and swam and consorted with his blood inside the syringe, and then he moved the witch's brew into his system again with a steady, practiced squeeze. "Chasing the dragon," Slater observed. Then Slater's pipe appeared as if by magic. He fired it up like a flamethrower and took a powerful hit. Tanner grimaced and then spiked himself, and the bootstring fell away. His jaw hung open. He waggled his head and tried to say something, but no words came out. "Yeah," he gasped at last. "Praise God." He rocked back into the chair, stood up, did a few knee bends. They all watched with some minor half-interest, Slater, Lynn Martin, Sister Mayo, and Brandon Nella Cruz, loose ends in the twisted fabric of the Marimont, unofficial custodians of the Tanner problem. And one by one they dropped their heads as the scorched foil made its way among them, passing hand to hand, pipes boiling, hot smoke, the drug vaporizing, combusting a galaxy of pleasure centers in the brain. "Here it comes," Lynn said. Tanner dove into his impression of Bruce Lee. It was awful. They took up the chant, "Bruce, Bruce, Bruce," and Tanner tossed his kid on the couch and capered around the room and glanced off the walls, whipped his long hair and kicked his broomstick legs in the air. He jerked and wheeled like an antic marionette, flinging roundhouse karate chops first one way and then another. "I'm a dangerous weapon," Tanner said. "I'm a samurai warrior." "Fists of fury," Mayo said. But suddenly the spring seemed to go out of him. The speed was on rewind. He limped crabwise into the kitchenette and heaved. "He shoots, he scores," Dela Cruz offered play-by-play. "This is a freak show," Mayo said. Rough trade, peacock in her own right. All fishnets and rip leather, hellfire, mohawk, and piercings. She took a slug of Thunderbird. "If I could get up, I'd leave," she said. "But I can't get up." Tanner wobbled on his knees in the corner. "A mercy over here," he groaned. "Come on, somebody. Chop, chop." Slater approached, extended a hand. After some effort, Tanner was up again, unsteady but upright nonetheless. "There you go," Slater said. Fresh bile matted his soul patch and his eyes were bug-like pop flash bulbs. "You look good," Lynn said. "Ready for action. Get him, outlaw." Tanner bolted and hit the door at a dead run, knocked it apart on the second try, drove himself into the hallway. They sat and listened to Tanner's maddened footfalls in the stairwell. Then something else drifted to their ears, a kind of rebel yell, and then something else. A yelp, a tumble, a crash. It was that kind of year. Fly-blown pages of calendars. Slater had lingered in San Francisco well beyond his purpose. He hadn't found Corey. She'd proven a phantom. He'd made no progress. True, he'd chased her fading memory down blind alleyways, followed her shadow swerve into the dark corridors of old photo albums and tattered phone books, made midnight calls to distant friends in sleepless towns, one-time friends, people he thought were sometime friends, searching for her and no other, had plunged headlong into a maze of dreams, strange echoes in yesterday's voices, followed lost roads going nowhere. He'd searched and agonized and labored in vain. Nor had he seized on a job of any merit beyond running dope all over the city for Tanner and Company, an occupation which supported his evolving taste for chemicals and which distorted and compromised everything else. His compass had run amok. Did it feel he was going in circles? Section 11352A of the California Health and Safety Code states, "Possession for sale of a controlled substance carries a mandatory minimum sentence, 3 years." So Slater would discover when his borrowed ride was pulled over in Oakland. "Seatbelt violation?" Slater had asked. He was taken into custody. After spending several weeks in jail and making several shambled appearances in court and finally signing a dim and impossible plea agreement, Slater was shackled aboard a bus for San Quentin and began his odyssey through the state correctional system. "Don't drop the soap," Tanner had advised. Slater's aim was to somehow emerge alive from the other side. Blood-smeared walls, fly-blown lives, days and nights of terror. Gladiator school, peeps and nations, New Jack City, yard in, yard out, the iron pile, cell block, lockup, tune-up, shakedown, Peckerwood, Norteño, Sereno, the shoe, segregation, the eternal moment, the dark crossing. Extension classes, required reading, In the Belly of the Beast, The Thief's Journal, In the Penal Colony, Soul on Ice, Don Quixote, De Profundis, The Cantos of Ezra Pound, The House of the Dead, A Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation. Bonhoeffer, Niebuhr, Eliot, Sartre, and Lowell, The King James Bible, The Apocrypha, Jailhouse Jesus, Choir Practice, Release Date, Gated Out, and Freedom. Slater, worse for wear and sleeved in prison tattoos, gathered his few books and shouldered his rucksack and shoved out of the Richmond BART station, effecting a soft landing a short leg across the bay in El Cerrito. In stale Victorian grandeur, his rooming house dominated one corner of Potrero and M Streets. At first it had been owned by a local banker, but the years passed and times changed and its rooms were converted into apartments, and tenants came and went and came again, and some died there, wrapped in stained yellow sheets on their beds or hung from suicide ropes lashed to the ceiling beams, their eyes bulging like two-minute eggs. In the parlor's half-light stood an old library table, ink-scuffed and derelict, slanting into a wall. It occupied a small alcove around the corner from the black staircase that turned and turned again and wandered into the gloom of the floors above. At this table, Slater began to engage himself with an accounting, a document of his personal labyrinth. Companioned by emptiness and the long dark of a mismanaged life, Slater would begin opening the cloth-bound notebook to a new page and feathering a pen over his knuckles. Results were mixed. He would pursue a few thoughts, run them out as far as he could, then abandon his efforts with a shrug. What little he succeeded in recording were instead glimpses of the day's events, mundane observations, the sketchy detritus and tailings of an imagination at odds with itself, at odds with its own pretensions and aspirations. Among the remainders from Devil's Due, The Journal of James Slater. The mind drifts in a turning cloud, and the street passes in its curious parade. The soul of a man is too easily lost. The millennium devises the day and is still. Churches fill with dark birds and dark wind. Churches fill with dark power. It is the end still. It is the welter of dark wind. It is the night that devises the dark. It is the night that devises its own indefinite chapter. It is the night that devises its own infinite end. You can't change yesterday. You can't even change today. And tomorrow is thrown in the fire. 6 weeks outside, the violent buzz of crystal meth again sizzled in Slater's ears in a wild frequency all its own, setting his nerves aflame. Recidivist, master addict, rehab was for quitters. He fled past the rows of decaying and spooked rooming houses and cut through an alley heaped with garbage and went into the back door of the Transit Lounge, a watering hole like many in the neighborhood, small and dark and narrow and limbed by doomed ruddy faces in the murk. A small beer always settled him. Slater swung up on one of the stools and said he had a powerful thirst, Sabbath or no Sabbath. To keep it holy, the saloon keeper said, and set a schooner of draft before him. Scattered across an interstate median, two cars ripped apart in a blaze, candling the night, smoking metal and disaster photos, patrolmen directing traffic as thunder rolls, an odious smell. Comes in the call from Portland, the call informing Slater of the accident, Jocelyn's accident. The police chaplain had traced Slater through parole records in San Francisco. She had been traveling in the wrong direction. Muscles in Slater's stomach tightened. The girls were in the car. Oh, Jesus, Slater said. He sagged. Is there someone there who could be with you? Say it. Tell me. It's a tragedy all around. They didn't survive, Slater said. No, I'm sorry. No one? Not one? I'm sorry for your loss. Slater groaned. Thank you, Slater said. Okay. He let the phone drop and, like a blind man, walked into the wall. On one of any number of sprawling overpasses in the Portland area, Slater may be seen, nowadays, a shoeless, mad-wigged figure in ragged sweatpants and parka, ranging up and down the pedestrian crossings, flailing his arms about and shouting in the rain. He has avoided bailing off one of the picturesque downtown bridges so far. He has not taken the plunge. Instead, he shouts, "View the body!" Instead, he cries, "Give him some love!" Between on-ramp and exit, tractor trailers with muddy Canadian plates rattle and foul the air and rumble north. Cars pitch and throttle and swoop lane to lane, black-wall tires hissing water and spun violence. "Devote yourselves now," Slater shouts. "Devotion is the answer." Arguing his case as if the matter were obvious.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was Ed Miller reading a really tragic story indeed. Lost Roads Going Nowhere is the history of lost opportunity and pain. From the very beginning, we get the feeling that Slater, the central character in Ed's story, is on a steep downhill slide. Failed marriages, seemingly not that much a concern for his children, no real profession or job skills, very little ambition or hope for a better life, for a while a new girlfriend, all the money he makes working hard for a time, wasted on drugs, a very unhappy mother, more dope peddling, arrested, and finally jailed in San Quentin. And even after he's released, we don't see any changes, any conversion, any rehabilitation, just more cheap boarding houses and dope dens. And finally, there's the shock of learning of the death of his former wife and both his daughters, at which point we just know the end is near. The question we might ask is, was there ever a time, perhaps the moment in Ed Miller's story tonight, where Slater could have turned things around? Or was it destined from the very beginning to turn out this way? Friends, Ed Miller hardly needs any introduction inasmuch as he's appeared on our program many times. His fiction has appeared in West Branch, The Antigonish Review, and Whiskey Island. His chapbook, The Whole Enchilada, was published by Cherina Baba Press. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with Archived Audio. Two stories next week, one by Dennis Shea, the other by Don Moody and his sister Linda Moody Huffman. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.